From the LifeWord studios, this is Life Perspectives with Michael Goring.
Joining me today is retired Los Angeles County homicide cold case detective J. Warner Wallace. Jim, it's great to see you, my friend. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this conversation.
So, Jim, in your work, you stress the importance of applying the principles of detective work to investigating religious truth claims. Can you walk us through how a skeptic might approach the investigation of Christianity in the same way that you would investigate, say, a cold case murder?
Well, first of all, just don't walk into it thinking you know the answer. Let's keep everything with an open mind. So you might walk into it thinking, hey, I don't believe in anything supernatural. And if this is a claim about something kind of supernatural, miraculous activity, even in the past, if it was a day ago or a thousand years ago, I'm not interested. But before you take that leap, just keep in mind that there are lots of things that we would say. I would say I was an atheist until I was 35, that I would have said I rejected the supernatural claims of anybody, but I did embrace Big Bang cosmology. In other words, I believe there was something outside of space, time, and matter that caused everything in the universe, which is space, time, and matter. You can't cause yourself. So there's something. If we're in a finite universe that has a beginning, and all the science points to that, well, then we know that there's something outside of space, time, and matter. The only question is that thing personal or impersonal? Mm-hmm. Can physics be the cause of this? Or if it's a being, well, then why would we limit ourselves to the kinds of miracles that are in the New Testament are small potato miracles for a being that could snap the entire universe into being from nothing.
Yeah.
So I think we have to at least have an open hand. Now, here's what I would say, though. I'm a skeptic like anybody else, and I was not raised as a Christian. No Christian friends growing up. I thought the claims were ridiculous because they were supernatural in nature. But when I read the Bible for the first time, I realized that these were claims, not just kind of arbitrary claims about the nature of God, like fortune cookies. These were claims by people who said this sequence of events occurred in history at a certain time. Mark is scribing for Peter. Well, Peter was an eyewitness. Matthew claimed to be an eyewitness. John claimed to be an eyewitness. Luke says he's talking to the eyewitnesses. So what we have are a collection of eyewitness accounts related to the story of Jesus. Well, so I just thought, as a skeptic, could we test these? One thing I do know how to do, because I work on cases from the past, when I've got the witnesses are now dead, the people who wrote the reports in which they were interviewing the witnesses, those detectives are now dead. So what all I have left are reports written by a report writer about something the reporter said. That's the Gospels. Well, if I know the skill set that's necessary to test those eyewitnesses, I simply applied that skill set to the Gospels.
That's incredible. So given the background that you have in solving cold cases, do you believe there is an inherent connection between the pursuit of truth in criminal cases as it is in the pursuit of the case for Christ, the pursuit of truth in matters of faith?
I think there is, because look, when you're working criminal trials, you are investigating objective realities of something that happened. We're not going to make a decision about opinions. Did this guy murder this woman, or did this woman murder this guy? Whatever it may be, and that we need to know: did this really happen? Is this claim objectively true, not just a matter of my subjective opinion? Mm. And this is the same claim here when it talks about the claims but related to Jesus. Look. There are a difference between objective truth claims and subjective truth claims. Subjective truth claims are like the opinions that are grounded in the subjects who make the claim true. If I told you that, coffee is the best morning drink, well, that's an opinion. It's not true for everyone, but it's true for me. But if I told you that isoniazid is the cure for TB, well, I might have a different opinion, but it won't cure TB. Isoniazid is made true by the object known as isoniazid. So it's an objective truth claim. So here's what it comes down to. The claim that Jesus is God, or the claim that Jesus rose from the dead, it could be false or it could be true. But one thing it cannot be made true or false is by my opinion. Mm-hmm. My opinion has no leverage on it at all. Just like this particular defendant, he cannot be guilty because I want him to be. He's only guilty if he did it. The same is true here when it comes to the story of Jesus. He cannot rise from the grave because I want it to be so. Either it happened or it didn't. So it's an objective fact about history. And just like in a murder, you're going to investigate these objective claims about the past. We're doing the same thing here.
So, I mean, like in today's culture, many will argue that Christianity is simply a product of cultural conditioning or personal preference. And right. So do you counter the claim? How do you counter the claim for religious belief is merely subjective?
Yeah, well, okay. So that's what I would say. So if ask yourself the question, can the subject make it so by simply willing it or wanting it or changing his opinion about it? If I said that Jesus rose from the grave, well, he may not have, or he may have. I cannot keep him from having risen from the grave by simply changing my opinion. How about this claim? God exists. That actually is an objective claim about reality. I'm not saying it is true yet, because once you discover what something is actually an objective claim rather than a subjective claim, all that's left to do is determine if it's true or false. So I could say that, you know, coffee is the best drink. Well, that's my opinion. You can't, how are you going to falsify my opinion? But if I said isoniazid again is the cure for TB, that's something you could test. You could know if it's true. And that claim is made true not by my opinion. So that's why this claim about God's existence or Jesus is God, that's a claim that's either true or false, but it's not a subjective claim. It's an objective claim. And by the way, nobody's going to, like, if I said to you, you know, the Green Bay Packers are still the best team in football, you could argue with me. And that's not what you believe. Okay, got it. But we're not going to probably argue that too far. But if I said to you, I said, my opinion is, let's say iced tea. Iced tea is the cure for my tuberculosis. And you said, no, I think the only cure for tuberculosis is isoniazid. Well, that's the kind of discussion that you ought to take part in, because it turns out that objective claims are worth our consideration. They're worth our discussion. They're actually even worth arguing about, because you might just save someone's life. But you're not going to probably change my life much or save my life by arguing about what the best football team is.
Right.
So in the end, these are the kinds of claims we at least ought to examine. And we certainly ought to take the time to present wisely to our friends who hold a different opinion. Look, Christianity is not just kind of a convenient way that I like to live. Christianity is a claim about the cure for what's killing us all spiritually.
Yeah.
If it is a cure claim, then it's a matter of life and death, spiritual life and death. So this is the kind of claim that I would think you would probably spend time trying to talk your sick loved one into taking the isoniazid, because if he thinks that iced tea is actually the cure, you ought to also spend the time trying to talk to your spiritually disconnected and non-believing friends, because it turns out that Jesus is the only cure for sin.
Yeah.
And he's the cure for what is separating us from God. And it's worth the time to discuss it.
You know, that is a, I hope our listeners, those who are watching, I hope they'll really take that to heart. If they're a believer, that they will really seriously take it from that vantage point, from that point of view, that we have loved ones who are spiritually sick, and Jesus is the only cure. That's a great analogy. How do you think the rise of postmodernism, with its emphasis on subjective truth, has influenced the way people view Christianity and other worldviews? I mean, is that?
Well, I think it has made a difference, right? Because the idea under postmodernism, this idea of relativism, is that really all truths are only really shaped and formed on the basis of the cultural context in which the claim is made. And your version of truth, given your context, might be different than my version of truth, given mine. But you'll notice that really breaks down when you get into criminal trials. So you can hold a relativistic view of truth, but if you're sitting on a jury and they have allowed you to still sit on the jury, it's probably because you hold an objective view about the nature of this defendant. You believe that someone actually did commit this crime, and that someone will, it's going to be true regardless of who you are on this jury. If he did it, he did it.
Yeah.
And so we hold this objective view about those kinds of things. When the rubber meets the road, we have a tendency to slip back into a very traditional objective view of truth claims. So I do think it's having an impact. And this is why the claim in John, the Gospel of John, chapter 14, where Jesus says he's the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through him, must seem ludicrous to a lot of people in the current context if they hold a more relativistic view of truth. you might say, well, that's true for you.
Yeah.
But that's not true for everyone. Well, it's just like the ice and I, is it? Mm-hmm. Can I really sit there and say, okay, maybe you're right. Maybe iced tea will work for you. Yeah. Would you really do that if somebody you truly loved needed the cure? I think in that moment, you would actually sift through all of these discussions about the nature of truth, and you'd arrive right back at the traditional view, because you know in the end that some things are objectively grounded. They're grounded in the nature of the object, not in the view of the subject who's considering the claim.
Yeah. Jim, you're a seasoned apologist. What do you think is the most significant challenge that's facing Christians today in defending their faith in this increasingly secular world? What's the greatest challenge that we're facing?
Well, if we're looking at just in terms of like what kinds of claims should we be prepared to respond to? I mean, that's one issue for sure. That's an issue of like, well, how should we, what's the one claim? That's kind of the question you're asking, I think, right? Like, yes, what's the one claim? Okay. Well, I think that we've shifted. I think you're my age group. I'm a boomer. Okay. Yeah. So I'm an old guy. And I think if you were to ask the questions, the kinds of questions we would ask now, back then at least, would have been, well, is it true really? Can you make a case for this? Show me that it's true. I think for my grandchildren, the question will probably be more aligned to, is it good? Because the culture is suggesting that they don't believe it's true, but what they really don't like is that it's a false claim that teaches something they don't think is good. So, and a lot is going to come down to how we behave morally, right? How we interact with the world around us. Issues related to sexual behavior, issues related to the sanctity of life. The things that the culture has now adopted and kind of given them their stamp of approval, the seal of approval, are the very things that Jesus was quite clear about, and the New Testament and the Old Testament are quite clear about. The traditional role of marriage and relationships and sexual relationships and gender identity, these are things that we the scriptures oppose what is being embraced in the world. Now, here's what's interesting. I do think if you read through Romans 1, you'll see that Paul says that the people who have kind of don't recognize the truth of God in the environment in which they live, they've rejected God altogether and replaced him with a lie. But it's not a lie. In the Greek, it's the lie. What is the lie? It's idolatry. That we have a tendency to worship the creations of God instead of the God who created them.
Yeah.
This idea of misplaced devotion is really bigger than we think. And I think it is the future that we're going to have to make a case to our young people, because we have a tendency to fixate on the things that God has created. And they're always in these three categories: sex, money, and power. Mm. And so what we're going to help our kids to see that is not where the answers are. That is not where your desires are going to be met. That's not where you're going to feel the most sense of fulfillment as a human being. It turns out you're focusing on the creation instead of the creator.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of where we're going to have to start now, you might have started in the past with somebody who's like, I don't believe the case for Christ. I don't believe the case for God. That seems to me like someone more my age. I think if you're younger than me, you're probably asking the question, I can't believe that you Christians think that way about this issue that I think is important, because now you actually worship this. You worship something about your identity. You worship something about your behavior. You worship something about what the world can offer you. And we're going to be able to make a case that there is a God of the universe who is your creator, your designer, who actually knows what's better for you than you know what's better for you. Let's put it this way.
And that's so countercultural.
Yeah. It is because we want to answer all of our own questions. We pridefully think that we can create our own purpose and meaning. But if I told you I have this device here and you didn't know what it was, but you could see it, one of the surest things you could do to discover its meaning and purpose is simply to go online, search for it, find it on a search engine, go to the manufacturer's website. And, oh, that's what it's designed to do.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. I understand that. What'd you just do? You know that the surest way to discover something's purpose is simply to ask the manufacturer. Mm. And that's true also for us. We're not the manufacturers, folks. If you want to know what your purpose and meaning is in life, it'd be wise to consult the manufacturer. And what we've done instead is to say, hey, I can just create my own purpose. And that seems to work for a season until something traumatic happens. And then you're questioning, well, what is this all about? I actually think the biggest issue we have today is how we form our identity and the relationship between identity and trauma. Let's put it this way. Every time you've ever experienced a trauma, you've also experienced a change in the way you saw yourself.
Yep.
Oh, I'm a married man. Oh, now I'm divorced. I've never been sick. Oh, now I've got this diagnosis. You see, it changes the way you see yourself. The reverse is also true. Every time you have an identity shift, you experience trauma. It works both ways. Trauma causes an identity shift. Identity shifts cause trauma. If you want the least traumatic, challenging life possible for yourself, you'd be wise to pick an identity that doesn't shift. Kind of simple. Now, yeah. What we have a tendency to do instead is to pick shifting identities, and we gather them from a number of places. But if we could put our identity in the one thing that doesn't shift. So what happens is, you know, small things can make us suffer. Small things can challenge us. You know, when I retired, it was hard for a number of years. I was trying to figure out who I was. I've known people who stayed way too long doing certain things because they just could not envision themselves as anything else. Well, if I would have just taken the view that, hey, I'm still in Christ, the Son, beloved Son of the Father, who loves us as his own children, I was that person before I retired, and I was that person after I retired. But because I wouldn't surrender and focus on that aspect of my identity, I struggled for years. Mm. So I think if we're going to, this is why Christianity is not just true, it's good.
Yeah.
And if you can simply surrender to it, you're not just surrendering to the claims of your creator, but you're surrendering to the plan of your creator. And he's got a plan for you. And he knows how you've been shaped. And he knows that if you won't put your identity in him, number one, you could argue that you're not saved as a Christian if your identity is not in Christ.
Right.
But two, you will suffer the ups and downs of your own identity formation for the rest of your life. So it is not just true. It is actually good for you.
Yeah. His plan is good.
Right.
You know, Jim, what I appreciate about you so much and what I love about your ministry is that you're examining the gospel from the vantage point of what you've done your entire career as a homicide detective, cold case detective. What's one of the most compelling pieces of evidence that you have found that supports the historical reliability of the gospel?
Okay, so if I was to tell you, okay, so I first started in by, I just needed to know, does it pass the test for eyewitnesses? Was it written early enough to have been written by, this is the same test we apply in the jury instructions in California. So this is what we tell jurors to consider when they're listening to an eyewitness on the stand. Was he there to see what he said he saw? So I needed to know, were these gospels written early enough to actually have been written by people who were there? Two, can it be corroborated in some way? Three, has it changed over time? Four, was it written by somebody or said by somebody who's got something to gain out of this? Mm-hmm. Got a motive that's sideways. Okay, that's how we evaluate eyewitnesses. But here's the bigger problem, I think, when people ask me this question. I'm a cumulative case guy. I'm working cold cases. Another way to think of cold cases is just lame cases. They're lame, and that's why they're cold. That's why they're unsolved, because there were no eyewitnesses. Perhaps it's a very, very faint case evidentially. So what I do death by 1,000 paper cut cases. I'm going to have 1,000 small paper cuts, so don't seem like much. And if I showed you any one of these pieces, you go, yeah, okay, well maybe he did it. But when you see 50 of them all pointing to him, the case is overwhelming. And you realize, yeah, it's kind of hard to see this out of the context of everything else you just showed me in the last 3 weeks in this case and trial. Well, the same thing was happening for me. So it's not just the way we test eyewitnesses, but it was also about looking at all the alternative explanations for the empty tomb and trying to figure out, do they work? Do the non-Christian explanations work? But it's not just that. It was also looking at the impact that Jesus had on culture, because if he is who he said he was, we should see a huge number of ripples in the little pond when Jesus's rock gets tossed in. I wanted to know, were those ripples there? It's not just that. It's that, do the claims of Jesus in the New Testament actually contribute to human flourishing? In other words, does he get us right? It's a bigger cumulative case. Does the document stand up to scrutiny? Does the claim of the resurrection stand up to scrutiny? Did he have the kind of impact we would expect if he really did rise from the grave? And does he know us? Does he explain us the way we really are? And it took me a number of years in books to kind of flesh that out. But as you look at this larger, if I was to diagram it for you, you'd see that there's hundreds of pieces of evidence in each one of these small categories. Was it early enough? Well, there's a bunch of data there. Can it be corroborated? A bunch of data there. You know, is there any motive? Has it changed over time? A bunch of data there. Has he had any impact on art, music, literature, education, science, and other world religions? There's a ton of data there. Is he describing the way we actually are and how we flourish, and the nature of humility and misplaced devotion and all the things, identity and all the things we talk about? Well, when you look at that whole set of evidences pointing to this one reasonable inference, it's just hard for me. If I want to live in the truth, and by the way, I wasn't looking for something. I know a lot of people who come to Christ because they've had great trauma that it fixed their lives. They were looking for something, looking for direction. That was not me. My wife wanted to go to church. I'll go. I wasn't trying to disprove her. I know Lee Strobel's a good friend of mine, and Leslie came to faith first, and he was trying to disprove her. I wasn't even that interested to try to disprove Susie. She wasn't a believer. She became a believer when I became a believer. So for me, it was just like, hey, is this true? If it's true, I'm in. Even though it's largely inconvenient. You know, if you think about it, my behavior before, and I felt very good about who I was, but it's a lot harder to live as a Christian.
Yeah.
But number one, we are going to become, listen to me, folks. This is going to become very unpopular.
Yeah.
If you're a Christian, you hold this view, but that's where your faith is going to grow. You know, I'm reading through the Gospel of Mark. It's the earliest gospel of all the gospels. And the amount of suffering that's described in the Gospel of Mark. Now, it's written in Rome at a time when Christians were starting to be persecuted. Tacitus says they were hated for their beliefs, the Roman historian. And Christians were suffering in Rome. You know, there's an early movement after Christianity became the religion of the empire in the fourth century. Some Christians looked at what Christians had become now that the religion had been legalized. And they said, this isn't nearly as devout. Like, we were better off when we were persecuted. The level of commitment in an entire movement, you know, moving out into the wilderness to explore your faith, because we've gotten kind of soft. Folks, we have been soft for hundreds of years.
Yeah, that's true.
And as persecution begins, and I think it's going to happen, at least we're not, if nothing else, we will not be a favored category.
Yeah.
You might just find that you'll have a deeper faith and a deeper sense of trust. And the people who remain will have to be the ones who are more committed.
Well, you know, and that's what we see happening in the Middle East. Where the gospel is thriving, it's out of persecution. And so I think that that's an astute analysis that probably in America, you know, certainly in my lifetime, I think that we're going to see a rise of persecution in believers, and that's where our faith will thrive.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and so we can't run from that. So here's what I would say: we're at a time where if you're raising Christian kids, now is the time to prepare them to stand firm in what is going to become an inconvenient truth. You can do it, but you have to know more about the truth, this truth, than any other truth you're going to know.
And I hadn't planned on plugging this in this interview, but you just touched on something that that my wife and I, our family, we've really sought out to be intentional about this, and that we have two sons. One is 17 and one is 13. Our 17-year-old, the last 2 years, has attended Summit in Manitou Springs, Colorado. I know that you're yep. one of the
good teachers. For you.
Yeah. Would you just take a few moments and talk about Summit and how amazing it is?
Yeah, happy to. So Summit Worldview Conference in Manitou Springs, Colorado is the single best place to send your kids in the high school years, because we start there in the ninth grade and we have them until about they're about sophomores, maybe in college, that age range of about 6 years there, where we see students come up. And it is the most intensive yet satisfying 2 weeks your kids will ever spend.
Yeah.
If you look at it on paper, you think, oh, it's going to be very much, we're going to push kids to think deeply about their faith and how it connects with every aspect of their existence. What does the Christian worldview say about every issue they're going to engage in the next 5 to 10 years as young adults? We're going to cover it, economics, sexuality, whatever it may be, we're going to cover. What does the Christian worldview teach about this? Now, if I told you that's what it's about, you might think, well, I'm not even sure my son or daughter would want to go. But it turns out it's equally as relational as it is informative. 100%. And the deepest relationships are formed up there with young people. They will want to go more than once. If you send your kids as a freshman, get ready to send them twice, because that's what happened to me. I mean, your kids will go and they'll go, okay, that was so good, I want to do it again. Yeah. So I think in the end, this is the kind of thing we ought to be seeking. Let's put it this way. Most of us as parents, if we think our kids have any ability, let's say they're playing volleyball, they'll send them to volleyball camps.
Yeah.
Spend unbelievable amount of money, weeks of training, to prepare them for something that, to be honest with you, is not going to be a significant part of their life 20 years from now.
Yeah.
It's just not. Why wouldn't you then invest in the thing that's going to set their eternity?
Yeah.
So we have to start thinking that way, especially in a world that I think is becoming hostile to our beliefs. We have at least have to give our kids the ability. You would not put them out, even for sports, for example, you wouldn't send your kids into that volleyball tournament or try to make that team if you hadn't prepared them. But what are we doing then if we're not preparing them spiritually? Yeah. So it's time for us to really kind of reprioritize.
I agree. And I just looked it up. I wanted to make sure that I had the right URL. Parents, Jay Warner Wallace, Michael Goring, we're both saying investigatesummit.org and invest in your kids' future, and they'll thank you for it.
For sure. Absolutely.
As we're kind of wrapping up, what's the most effective way, do you think, that Christians can approach non-believers to engage in meaningful conversations about faith, about apologetics? What's the most meaningful way?
Well, if you notice, when Jesus starts teaching publicly, he teaches in parables. And you see this first time he teaches publicly in the Gospel of Mark, he teaches in parables, he teaches the parable of the sower. And his disciples are like, why are you doing that? First of all, what does that even mean, what you just said? Yeah. And why are you speaking that way to others? Well, I think what he does is he provokes a response. He speaks in a way that is very much provokes people to think deeply. And he can see who the deep thinkers are. The deep thinkers are going to come to him and ask questions. And those are the ones who ended up becoming his disciples. And he says that some people don't have ears to hear. I think we need to be really sensitive to the people in our life who have ears to hear. And you can do it by simply talking about the things that, you know, when I was younger, it would have been, well, I don't think it's evidentially true. Now it might be, I don't understand why the world is the way it is. Well, it turns out the Christian worldview has something to say about it. Mm-hmm. And you can even ask that question. You know, tragedies happen. How do you think these tragedies could happen if there's a good God? It's questions that cause us to think. But here's what I would say. A lot of us who are involved in some form of what we think of as Christian ministry, well, we sometimes think then that takes us off the hook. I mean, that's all I'm doing is thinking about Jesus and talking about Jesus in my professional or in my, you know, in my free time here. Well, for the rest of us, I mean, don't let that take you off the hook.
Yeah.
I sometimes will go someplace to preach the gospel, get on the plane on the way home, and I don't want to talk to anybody. Yet there's a person sitting right next to me who I could engage for the next 2 hours. Now, I'm not going to preach at him. I'm just going to ask him the questions. Like, what do you think the meaning of life is? Like, where do you get the most sense of purpose and meaning in your own life? And how does it work? That's a good question. I'll tell you why. Because everything that people typically look to for meaning and purpose at some point has failed them.
Yeah.
And it gives us a chance then to talk about, well, what's the one place you could put your identity that would never fail you?
Never fail you.
So this is I think we have to be more clever. Yeah. Jesus was clearly, because he could have just said, hey guys, I am him, Yahweh, standing right here. I'm going to have to die for your sins. Simply trust me. He never did that. Instead, he constantly provoked people to think more deeply about what they believe was true. And to investigate with him, to dig deeper, ask another question, ask me another question. And that's the kind of stuff I think we need to be prepared to do. And I'll just hat tip a good friend of mine, Greg Kokel, who's got a book called Tactics that I think if you're kind of in this sphere, you probably have already heard it or read it. But it's a great book that just helps you to initiate these kinds of questions-driven conversations. I do think that that is really the wisest thing right now, is for us to learn how to form question-driven conversations.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, some people may look at that and they may say, that's intimidating to me. That's overwhelming to me. You have a wonderful resource through CodeCaseChristianity.com. And I would just encourage people to utilize that resource, investigate the claims of Christianity, and be ready to give an account. That's what Peter tells us.
Yeah, and we try to have a lot of material on that website. All free. I mean, look, don't ever buy any author. I'm an author. You don't need to buy my books until you exhaust what we offer for free. And you'll find on that website, there's way more that you can get for free. I think you should. This is a great age in which you can do that. Here's what I would say. How many of you out there are involved in a sports league? If you're a guy right now, you're playing fantasy football, how many hours a week are you spending reading up on who you're going to play next week?
Yeah.
We do it, right? We have hobbies, and we are so interested in our hobbies that we can transfer that passion to our kids like that. We don't even have to think about it. As a matter of fact, we can strike up a conversation with a stranger if we see them on any way we can talk about the things that we love. Here's what I would suggest. There's no like systematic approach to this. Simply transfer your passions. We do a better job of transferring our fanship of our sports teams than we do our faith.
Yeah.
We talk about it organically at the dinner table. We talk about it on road trips. We're geeked out about this stuff. It just spills over. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. This is true for anything that's in your heart. So you already are doing it with strangers. You're just not doing it about Jesus with strangers. Because to be honest, we identify in other things. And we study up on other things. Mm-hmm. How much discretionary time do you think you have right now? And where do you think you're spending it? It turns out we have a lot more than we think we do. And if you turned off your Netflix and YouTube TV and all the other stuff that we spend hours on, I don't even know this year how many hours I'm retired now, so I can have a little more discretionary time. But how many hours did I waste on pro football this year? Oh my goodness. I mean, I'm a huge football fan. I used to do chapels for the Green Bay Packers. And I'm just going to tell you that I wasted way too much time on football this year. And I was running with my wife this morning and I was telling her about why this game we watched last night, why it turned out the way it did and what's wrong with the offensive line and blah, 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 blah. And at some point she had to laugh and stop me. We're running. She's laughing because like, why do you know all that? Like it's what and I had to apologize. Yeah. Like, does she even care about that? Probably not as much as I do.
Yeah.
But I'm almost embarrassed about how much minutia I know about something that, to be quite honest, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Well, we at least have to know that much about what does.
Yeah, that's good. Jim, thanks for the great discussion. We could talk for hours. I appreciate your time, and I hope you'll join us again in the future for additional episodes. To learn more about J. Warner Wallace, visit coldcasechristianity.com. I'm Michael Goring. This has been Life Perspectives. Thanks for watching.